Escalating, and we're live. Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where this finds you in the time zones. This is Walt. I'm the owner of Hazard Studio and a sometime associate for the Banff Podcast. And today on the Indie Creator Spotlight, we are talking to Mr. Ed Jowett. How are you, sir?
Hello, I am great. Thank you very much, and thanks for sitting down to have a chat with me.
Absolutely. And we are also excited to find out that today is your birthday.
It is.
Happy birthday, many happy returns, and but we want to go back to birthdays of yesteryear and talk a little bit about comics. So you are a writer of comics, and we're going to be diving into that a little bit today because you do have an active project on Kickstarter. But before we get there, we know that sometimes, because we've talked to fellow co-host Aid Smith, we've talked to a couple of other guys from your side of the pond, such as even the likes of Dan Abnett. What was getting into comics like as a young guy in Great Britain? What was it like? Did you have comic shops? I know that the comics landscape before like 2000 AD and stuff like that was a little sparse.
I'm going to have to be honest here. I'm quite young. It is my birthday. I'm only 31 now. So, a lot of the guys that you've probably spoken to are a little older than I am. You know, maybe they have 10, 20 years on me. So they remember different things about the way getting into comics was. Now, when I was growing up, comics were not very much of a thing, like as a general rule. There were comic shops. They did exist, but in general, you know, I didn't really know very many people who read comics. My introduction to Marvel and DC were through the Spider-Man and Batman animated TV series. That's how I learned about those characters. And also, obviously, the Adam West 60s Batman, which is still brilliant. I love it. It's so much fun. Therefore, comics were kind of not really such a thing, at least not superhero comics per se. I only ever collected one comic in my youth. It was, in fact, Sonic the Comic.
Really?
Which I absolutely loved. I started collecting about issue 70, and I had a friend who had all the back issues before that. And I'd go around to his house, and we'd go ahead and we'd read all the older comics and sort of work our way through. And it was something that I really, really did enjoy. And I've learned since I got into comics that a lot of the things that I sort of took for granted about the way it was written or the way particularly the way the lettering was done. Because Sonic is always moving. On every single panel, he's moving. He doesn't stand still because he's Sonic the Hedgehog, right? So, all of the dialogue bubbles have massive long stalks to get to where his head is because you write it on the left-hand side and by the time you've read it, he's crossed the panel. So they do this sort of visual cue that gave you that feeling that he was always moving really quickly. And that was one thing that in a very recent project called Blue Shift, which is actually about a speedster, we actually sort of picked up that feel, that sort of that long stalk, that moving on every panel feeling, in order to try and go, okay, look, here's a bit of an homage to the way that Ed, you know, did comics. But getting into comics for me was actually, you know, in terms of superhero comics or more serious sci-fi comics or you know, any other kind of comic apart from Sonic the Comic, quite frankly, was sort of an 18-year-old university kind of thing. When I started meeting sort of a few more like-minded people who introduced me to various bits and pieces. And at that stage, you know, it was relatively easy because online shops existed. Anything you wanted, you could just, boom, you got it.
Nice. Now, was when you started getting stuff online, was it really expensive to have it shipped to the UK?
No, because most things could be shipped from your local comic shop or a relatively close comic shop, you know, within the UK. So, you know, sort of your, I don't know if you've ever seen the TV series Spaced. But the Fantasy Bazaar, the comic shop in that, is 100% the way they are. You know, that's exactly what they're like. And the guys in them are usually fantastic, fantastic people. But, you know, it's like, okay, well, you order it and you'll order it from there. You know, you'll get it off maybe Amazon or maybe off their own website directly. But they'll ship it to you, and it's all already within the UK anyway. So really, it's not too bad.
That's pretty cool. So when you started getting into comics at university, and you're starting to develop your taste, what did you drift toward the most?
I drifted towards the sci-fi stuff, and also the superhero stuff, and particularly the sci-fi superhero stuff that sort of sits in the middle. So Green Lantern was very quickly a favorite. You know, the idea that a superhero could actually be in space. Okay, well, that's awesome. Why did I never even think of that before? You know, I mean, it's like, for some reason, it had just never occurred to me. You know, I also loved Iron Man. I love the Iron Man comics, particularly sort of the older ones, sort of 80s, 90s, sort of the stuff that by then was sort of 10, 15 years old, at least.
Nice. So did you get to check out actual issues in your hand of like Demon in a Bottle and stuff like that, the big Tony Stark storyline?
I didn't get to touch that one in particular. That one I got digitally and I read digitally. But I also, oh, you know what else I read? I read a lot of Spider-Man 2099.
Oh God. So good.
After the Shattered Dimensions Spider-Man game came out on PS3.
Right? How weird but cool was that?
That was such a good game. I love that game. And you know, they made a sequel as well, Edge of Time, where you also get to play as Miguel and Peter. But yeah, I mean the craziness of these four universes all sort of colliding together, and oh man, and you're running around, you're doing the noir, and then instantly there's a tonal shift and you're doing the ultimate, which is so much more. It's it's such a sort of a varied experience across the game. You don't have time to get bored.
That's fantastic. And I assume at some time during university is when you also developed a love of role-playing games.
It is actually, yeah. I mean, I'd role-played in the past, but the first time that I actually began role-playing sort of with other people other than my family or friends, you know, sort of immediate friends, was... Yeah, it was at university. I went to the Indoor Gaming Society. I sat down. I played one session. They said, Ed, we're short of GMs. Can you GM, please?
And the rest is history.
And the rest is history. I've not stopped GMing. But it was that which got me into role-playing games first and then later comics. Because every year they did a 24-hour game. And the tradition was that the GMs, you know, you get six or seven GMs who'd come together and they create a universe. The previous year had been a low fantasy setting. And this year it was therefore decided we were going to do a sci-fi setting. And the next thing you know, they're going, okay, well, we've got this idea, which is basically Firefly. In the center, there's loads of civilization, and out on the edge, there's a lot less. Let's make it a bit cyberpunky so corporations are in charge. And oh dear, now we need some alien races. Anyone have any ideas? I'm like, I've been a Trekkie since I was young. My mother was very into Star Trek and I inherited that. And, you know, I've been sort of drawing and creating alien races for years and years and years. So, I handed them two of mine, which were the Yalutians and the Zimians, which I'd invented when I was about seven. And they were just perfect for the setting, you know, these squids in human-shaped suits that wear them to interact with humanity because humanity is so xenophobic. And these insectoids who completely can't take advantage of that, and therefore, you know, there's a lot of racial prejudice against them by the humans. You know, they're unsure how to deal with a sort of a seven-foot insect, you know, that's sort of talking to them. And you
And these are concepts that you came up with at the age of seven?
Yeah, it was actually, yeah.
That's pretty advanced. I've been
creating universes a very long time.
That's pretty cool.
And yeah, I mean, we basically put this game together and it ran really well. And then when I started role-playing again a couple of years later after I left university, I was focused on my career. and all that boring stuff. And when I started role-playing again a couple of years later, I sort of resurrected that campaign and ran a group of friends. It was 10 people. 10 people in one
big table. One group.
It's a big table. But I ran them through this campaign, and they all loved it. And my brother turned to me and said, hey, can you write down the rules? Because I'd like to run the next campaign. And then I wrote down the rules, and then I showed them to a friend, and he said, oh my goodness, why aren't you publishing this? And boom. But during that process of sort of writing it up and publishing it, I realized very quickly I can write certain kinds of stories and certain kinds of things, but I'm not very good at emotional engagement with a character. I can definitely write aliens who have all kinds of weird emotional reactions to things, but for some reason I can't write sort of human engaging stuff. And really that's something that comes with experience and a lot of writing. So you know, I went out looking for someone to give me a hand, and the person I ran into was Jonathan Lewis, who has a lot of years writing for comics. Now, John said, you know what? I reckon that a comic for this would be just the ticket. I reckon it would be great. We can make it a short 12-pager that explains this session that we're going to run at conventions, like how all those characters that you're going to play, how they got there. And that became the Last Stand of Stiletto Unit comic. It's only 12 pages long. It was just a short thing, and we sold out. We sold out of everything at our first convention.
That's amazing.
I mean, you know, we were there running role playing games, and we sold out the comics as well as the small number of role playing game primers we had with us. And you know, we were like, okay, so what are we going to do now? And we started looking at other comics in the sci-fi universe, and we also started looking at superheroes, because obviously he had, with so many years experience writing comics, he'd done a lot of superhero stuff. You know, we decided we were going to make a superhero universe together that would be our next big role-playing game. Things didn't quite work out that way. He had some personal stuff come up, and things got delayed. But actually, we've just recently finished the Kickstarter for Era the Empowered, which is that superhero role-playing game. You know, in between, we did some other role-playing games. And while we were working on Era the Empowered, you know, we sat down with some of our writers from Era the Consortium. And we said, okay, look, we want to write some comics. Let's all of, well, the three writers, that was John and Amy and Jennifer, the three sort of main writers on Era the Consortium. I sat down with all three of them and I said, look, let's all write a comic together. So each of you will write a comic with me. And I co-wrote on all of the comics. And so the first one, Lacuna, was written by myself and Amy. And John, obviously, with all those years of experience, he did a lot of dialogue editing. He did a lot of fixing. Oh, you can't put this on a panel because you can't show this kind of motion. It's not really practical. You know, and it was very much a learning experience for everyone involved. But, you know, we really captured the essence of this character. It's become a reasonably popular comic out of the ones that we've made. We moved on to do Blue Shift more recently, who is, as I said, she's a speedster. John and I wrote that one together. We had a bit of fun with the character. You know, this is someone who thinks so quickly that she talks slowly, because she considers everything, you know, she considers everything, like every possible iteration of what she might say and what the reactions might be, and then responds in kind of the normal human time, which is, you know, sort of a really interesting little quirk for a speedster.
And one of the things I noticed about the, you have the cover on your current Kickstarter for Blue Shift, the uniform. That kind of grid pattern on a uniform, is that tough to draw on every panel?
So I believe it was done with a CGI texture.
Nice.
The guy who does our drawing and
colors
for the Blue Shift and the Violet, but not for Lacuna. Someone else did that, but he had to drop out. So Ramat stepped forward and said, hey, I'll do the colors. And I said, cool. Yeah, he uses a lot of sort of CGI textures where you get to the point that it's a bit difficult to sort of draw by hand, because that hexagon would take forever, right? So he's got, you know, he's got these CGI textures. He warps them and he makes them shape to the body so that it works. And you know, I think the effect really is very, 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 very good. Did you notice that it's very much sort of a Flash reference, this running off the page pose?
Oh yeah.
You know, we decided to go, okay, look, she's a speedster, Flash is the speedster. If we're going to do something, what else do we do, right?
Yeah, very, very cool. The, excuse me. Now, moving into comics and actually getting into the process of comics, when you decided, you know, these are my ideas, these are great superhero ideas, and great ideas that can further my science fiction stuff too, I'm going to write a comic, let's do this, and then you sit down. Did you know how to script? Did you know how to set panel arrangement and stuff like that? Or did you kind of work with your artist and say, hey, you know, we're learning this as we go?
Well, I took a big lead off John. So I had a massive, massive leg up from all of those years of experience. You know, it cannot be overrated how much that actually helped and made it sort of a doable thing. Because I reckon if I'd tried to do it on my own, it would have been absolutely hopeless. And that's one of the reasons I've recently put out a call for artists, writers rather, for a number of new superhero lines, working in the same way, sort of co-writing with me to make sure that all of the stuff fits the universe properly. And you know, they're doing a lot of the writing, and the way that I try to pass on that experience is I do literally go, okay, here is one of our scripts. This is the way we lay it out. We do every page has to be on a new page, and every panel, you know, a panel title looks like this, and the description looks like this, and the dialogue looks like this, and so on and so on and so on. One of the things that I understand that we do that is fairly unique is we use a lot of images. We go on Google. There are so many poses out there. You know, like if you want to find a pose of someone headlocking someone else, you know, rather than writing 50 words to explain exactly what position they're all in, you can find an image of exactly that, right? Or at the very least, like this, but their head's pointed this way instead of that way, or whatever, right? We use a lot of images. We use a lot of references because a lot of the artists that we work with don't have English as a first language. Because obviously we are fairly budget restricted, being very small. That's often something that a lot of sort of particularly Eastern or European artists are able to work for a much lower number than someone who lives in the UK or in the US, because their cost of living is so much lower. So, you know, they're happy to work for a lower number, and have the regular work and know that stuff is coming, because Romad hasn't stopped since October. He's just done Blue Shift, and now he's finishing Violet, and then he's going to move straight on to Penumbra. We're just doing comic after comic after comic, and we're just chaining it with them because they're roughly paying for themselves with a little bit of extra oomph out of the Kickstarter. So, you know, we're just going, okay, next one, next one, next one. And he's loving it. You know, he's getting to refine his style. He's getting to learn more, because there really is only one way to learn how to do stuff. And this applies to writing. It applies to artwork. It applies to everything. And that is to keep doing it. And as you keep doing it, you'll get better and better and better and better. You'll realize the stuff you're doing wrong. And, you know, for a freelancer, I work with a lot of them. And the opportunity to actually have that and regular, and maybe it's not paying as well as the really, really big boys are being paid, but, you know, it's being paid at a reasonable rate that you can work with. And you know, it lets you have that repetition, that permanent state of I am working and I am getting paid and I am able to continue to improve and refine my style. And we, as the publishers, get the benefit of this person's style improving over time. You know, it's this person is not someone who's at the top of, you know, at the top of the industry. We aren't expecting to achieve that, but we get someone who's really, really good, you know, for where they're at, and then we help them improve. And we work with them, and we keep giving them work until they say, you know what, I'm ready to go up to the next tier. Are you ready to pay me for the next tier? And then we make a decision, right?
Right on. That's pretty cool. So now that we've kind of been sussing out your process, sussing out how things have been going, what was the first comic that you did?
So the first comic that I did was the Last Stand of Stiletto unit that I mentioned. It was only a short one, though. So I would call the first comic that we did really was Counting Down from One. And this one, the whole thing about my sci-fi role-playing game is that it's got a huge expanse of history, right? And at some point, after our very first Kickstarter got cancelled, we cancelled it. It wasn't going to fund. I didn't understand Kickstarter well at the time. And I'm now 29 Kickstarters later. You know, I understand it a lot better. I've not had another failure since. But unfortunately, that one, I went in with misconceptions. So we had this idea after that stopped that we could do a campaign where you start at the end of the history and go back in time and change it. And Counting Down from One is about a group that does exactly that. They try to go back in time and murder someone called Benjamin Hayden. Benjamin Hayden is probably the most important single person in the consortium history, because he recognized what was going on, despite the fact everyone loses their memories when they wake up after being in stasis. He recognized what was going on, and he adapted, and he began to control so much of the society that then made it form into this sort of corporate sort of dystopia. And he runs Hayden Bank, which is the only bank in the whole consortium. Across the three star systems, you have to bank with Hayden Bank. You have no choice. So these people decide they're going to go back in time and kill him. Because if they kill him, then probably Hayden Bank never forms. And various other things as a result turn out very, very differently. And then, as it's a one-way trip, think Terminator, really. There are a lot of Terminator references in the visuals, in the way that they travel back in time with no equipment, no clothes, nothing. They go back in time, and their intention is to kill him as the first step, and then to continue shaping history to make sure that it goes in the direction they want it to. And I wrote an entire campaign. I'm actually 4 years into that campaign now, with monthly sessions on our Patreon.
That's deep. That's real deep.
We're just approaching, we've finished session 47, just being released. We've written session 49 and are getting ready for session 50. So actually this month, end of this month, is our 4 year anniversary.
That's crazy.
It's nuts. But everyone has been so supportive. They've, you know, all of our patrons, there are some people who've been there right since day one of Patreon. And more people have come in as well, and it's made it possible for us to just continue just a monthly session, you know, of something that's exploring this incredibly detailed history and going, okay, well, what if? What if? What if? What if? And we're able to sort of shape stuff and do really, really crazy stuff. We actually have a point where the characters, they know that the bug war with the Zimians, the big bug people, is about to start. So they secretly go through a wormhole to reach them and implant implants, like cranial implants, in Zimians' heads so that they can then control the Zimian side of that war as well as the human side.
So it seems like it's just all nonstop craziness all the way around.
It's got some crazy bits, but it's also definitely got some really, really solid opportunities for great storytelling.
So as we move forward, kind of like shifting over back to the superhero stuff.
Mm. Yeah, well, that was the next thing. So we went on to Lacuna.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, Lacuna it's really a coming of age story. This guy, he already has powers. And he's been using them to go out and beat up street thugs.
like you do.
That's what he's been doing. I mean, he for his own reasons is a bit traumatized. His parents died, very kind of cliche sort of superhero reasons. But, you know, he's out there fighting street punks, and he runs into someone who has a very different outlook on life, despite also being an empowered. And she's the first empowered that he's ever met. She's called Penumbra. And she's also sort of the thread that ties a lot of the other comics together. She's going to have her own comic. She's had her own two spin-off comics, but she's going to have her own sort of mainline comic. I mentioned it a few minutes ago, after Violet is complete. And he meets Penumbra, and sort of his entire outlook changes. He's been living with his uncle, and he decides to leave. He decides that he's going to go it on his own after meeting Penumbra. And he finds that it's not quite the way he expected it to be. By the end, he's actually faced another supervillain against whom his powers are almost useless. He has the ability to create portals. But because this individual has super hearing, when he's about to charge through the portal, you know, and appear from nowhere, the guy can hear it through the portal, and he's right there with a counter, right? So this guy is just kicking his ass. Penumbra turns up and saves the day, and all of this is a catalyst for Lacuna to think about his life, to think about why he does what he does. You know, his uncle has pretty much reached the point where he's going to send him to a sort of school for troubled boys. You know, he's only 16. His uncle is only about 20. You know, Lacuna's parents obviously died, and his uncle took over guardianship. And you know, he's at the end of what he knows how to do. He doesn't know how to deal with this kid who's just violent all of the time. And, you know, it's really about Lacuna coming to terms with that and becoming more of a whole human being, you know, growing up, really. So it was a great story to write. I think it's an example of something that most people go through at some point in their lives. You know, most people have one event that they can look back afterwards and say, that was the moment where I really did my growing up. You know, that was the moment that made me who I am today. So I really enjoyed writing that from that perspective. And Amy, my co-writer on that project, she was fantastic. She's really got a great grasp of storytelling. She also has a bunch of kids. So, you know, she had a, you know, some of them are teenagers. So she had a great sort of mindset for what kids would look like, you know, in this universe, and what, you know, imagine what your kids would look like if they had superpowers, and how it might go horribly wrong.
Right on. Right on. Now when you're doing this stuff and putting this stuff together, does I know you guys said that you script using a lot of images and stuff like that, especially when you're talking volatile teenagers. I mean, is there a lot of volatile teenager, you know, photo reference on the internet, or is it something where you get a small description and then you kind of let the artist interpret a little bit, or do you really script tight where it's, you know, I want it looking this way with this particular angle, and then the next panel is how tight is your scripting process, especially when you're talking something that's so fraught with emotion that an artist might be able to help you with?
So for me, there is a line. There's a very, very clear line which sits between content and execution. I do not cross that line ever. You know, that very, very occasionally, and this is mostly John, will go, okay, look, we want to do this kind of angle because we want to show her running up. I'm just thinking of a blue shift thing. She ran up outside the doors, look, and was standing there looking at the doors going, oh, well, okay, you could have picked the lock. You could have, you know, found a back door. No, we'll just smash the door in. That's sensible. Award-winning brains work at work here, folks. but we had this specific thing that John wanted to do. He had this very visual idea of what this panel looked like. Personally, you know, I will go, okay, this person, I'm using the headlock example again, this person has this person in a headlock, their head is pointing this way, and then I'll go, you draw that from whatever angle you like, you know, wherever that makes sense to show, make sure that you show the police siren, you know, the lights in the background that the police are coming, or, you know, she's tying them to a lamppost, you know, whatever it is that's, you know, content I go as tight as I possibly can, unless I really don't care. In the cases that I don't care, you know, I go, okay, look, this is open to you. You know, we've already themed what the city looks like. Let's go nuts. Let's see what you want to do that will make this, you know, your execution as much as ours. Because I think that it's very, very important that the artist has a large stake and a large influence over the way the thing appears. I don't want to just sit down and pay someone to do exactly what I've got in my head, right? I want another interpretation. I want to pull something in. And I probably ask for changes on one in 30 panels. You know, like, it's really, really, as most people can understand an emotion, even when English isn't their first language, you know, they can understand this person is angry. You know, he's violent. He's really beating up this superhero as best he can. And here's the sequence of events, right? He throws her through a window. He you know, throws her down on the ground and slashes at her back and so on and so on and so on. This is all sort of individual panels from Violet. She gets quite badly injured during the story, actually. Which is, and if you don't mind if I segue into that.
Please.
It's actually one of the things that I think is really interesting about the story, because here is a superhero who fights a supervillain, and she is defeated, convincingly defeated. The police arrest her. You know, like literally, she is left beaten and bleeding on the floor. Rampage, he's a sort of a lizard man with the ability to sort of turn invisible, like a chameleon. Somewhat inspired by the lizard and somewhat inspired by SBO, the chameleon from Sonic. So she has no chance, and she knows pretty quickly that she has no chance. And she can't even escape. You know, he is too quick. He's designed to defeat her. And he defeats her convincingly. He leaves her lying on the ground, covered in garbage, you know, and the police walk up. You know, he's like, because I should actually say, this guy is a criminal that she's arrested many, many times, right? When he was human, and then he got upgraded. So he thinks it's poetic justice that she's then arrested. You know, because she has super strength and the ability to fly, you know, arresting her doesn't last very long once she sort of regains her senses. You know, break the handcuffs, fly through the roof of the police car, you know, you're gone. And at that point, the sort of the halfway point of the comic, she has been defeated. She now has to look at herself. She has to go, okay, am I going to be a superhero? Or am I going to go, oh man, I'm going to die if I go back out there, right? I mean, is she going to let Rampage, this creature with unstoppable rage, for lack of a better phrase, not to jump on the Hulk too much there, but you know, he's not like anything she's ever faced before. Is she really going to let him be the leading power in the city? And it's all easy to say no. I'm not going to do that. But she has just been beaten to within an inch of her life. You know, how do you go back out there and face this thing that's already beaten you once? And again, that's you've probably noticed that there's a sort of something like a similar theme between that and Lacuna. It's about pivotal moments in your life, and it's about making decisions that change who you are forever. And I really think that rather than starting with an origin story, you know, here's how I got my powers, I really feel like that's the way to start a superhero, to start a superhero story. You know, you start with, okay, I've got my powers, but that's not what changes who you are. It's the moment where you meet a challenge that you can't defeat that changes who you are. Because, you know, and it's no different for a non-superpower person, any normal person on the street. You grow up, you get stronger, you're taller, you run faster, whatever. But you aren't automatically, you know, the person who you're going to be. You usually have to go through the crucible in some way. And that's for a starting superhero, that's what interests me. That's the stories that we want to tell.
And as far as that goes, when you have a character like this, how much of yourself and how much of that crucible have you had to go through yourself before you can write something like this?
I have gone through a lot of things that are perhaps analogous. I've never actually been beaten up.
Well, that's a good thing.
Not that badly.
Especially by a lizard.
Especially by a lizard. But, you know, I have gone through some very, very traumatic and emotional times. I've reached points where I've sat down and gone, I don't know how to do this anymore. You know, I don't know how I can leave this room today and go back and do this thing tomorrow. And yeah, there's some of myself that goes in there. I'm sure that's also true for the other writers. On Violet, it was Jennifer, another of the writers from Era of the Consortium. She specializes in very, very dark stuff. And she's very, very good at it. I mean, if you read through the Era of the Consortium core rulebook, I guarantee you there will be one story that sticks in your head. And that was written by her. I don't even need to tell you what it is. I know that it's going to be that one because that story stands out in such a way that just makes you go, oh, right. And Violet is very much a similar kind of thing. I mean, Violet, Viola, her human persona, has all kinds of problems as well. You know, her parents are immigrants. She was born where she is now. I should say this isn't based on Earth. It's based on a sort of, I can't believe it's not Earth.
Right. How close is it to what we got going on? Well, other than the superpowers, that is.
It's pretty close. It's sort of very similar to sort of Earth in the late 90s, early 2000s, maybe all the way up to 2010s, and it's kind of all smushed together. I've de-emphasized a few things like the internet, because the internet is problematic, in my opinion, for superheroes. It's really not that hard to have someone with a camera standing in front of you ready to upload your picture to the internet. So I've sort of de-emphasized the internet a little bit. It does exist, but it possibly exists more like it did in the late 90s than it does now. You know, not everything is YouTube and Facebook. You know, so it's sort of a universe to the left, if you like. It's very, very similar in feel. And her parents are immigrants to the country they're in. They're there legally, but their visa expires every year, and they have to reapply every year. And every year they're told, well, we'll do it this time, but we're not doing it again. You know, you're coming to the end now. You're going to have to go back. You know, that's kind of a core theme of the comic as well. That's it's mentioned, but we aren't there yet. You know, in later stories, that's probably going to become a lot more of an issue. Because, you know, she's close to her parents. She goes around and spends time at their house and so on. She's a student. She's a student of mythology, which is sort of a little bit of irony that we like to play with. At one point, she sat in the library going, well, you know, if he was a reincarnation of an ancient god, I'd be fine. I'd know exactly what to do.
And this is in reference to her nemesis during the story?
Yes, indeed, yeah. You know, we've had some fun with it. And John is very good at sort of bringing these slightly humorous, slightly pathetic things in. You know, like you're sat there, you're trying to figure out how to beat a supervillain. Ugh, I wish he was the reincarnation of an ancient god or something. That'd be so much easier.
Now, when working with some of these artists, especially you said sometimes there's a barrier due to language. Is Google Translate your friend? I mean, how are you going about that?
As a rule, the answer is no. Google Translate is not a good way to go about that, because there are a lot of words. Avocat is one of my favorite. It's both a judge and an avocado in French. You don't want to get those two confused.
No, probably not.
You know, it's what I generally do is I send it out in English, and I occasionally get back a request like, you know, I was doing this, and you said that she scooped this person up. but the only kind of scoop I know is ice cream. So what do you mean? You know, I occasionally get requests like that back. I've never actually worked with anyone who knows no English yet. You know, it's always the case of their English is way better than my Czech or Chinese or whatever it is. But it's really a case when you're working, and this is advice for anyone who's looking to start out. If you are looking to work with someone who is not English and you are an English first language speaker, try to keep things as simple and to the point as possible. Short sentences that describe exactly what's happening. And if you write in that way, everyone is going to understand it, even if they put it in Google Translate. I've never really had any hilariously wrong panels, like where it was just totally hilariously wrong and it was very clear they hadn't understood. A lot of people do use Google Translate, and I know that, and I've noticed from some things, but they only get it like slightly wrong because of the way that we construct the sentences.
Yeah, I've noticed I speak more than one language, and the funniest colloquial accident that we had ever had was when I was very young, and we were talking to an exchange student, and we asked them. I had heard that there were job security in the country, and I had asked if anybody ever got fired. And the horrified look on this poor student's face.
Oh, you said shot, didn't you?
Well, he thought that I meant, dude, when somebody loses their job, we take them out and shoot them. So yeah, colloquialisms like that can get a little bit dicey. So
it can be really, really confusing for some people. And yeah, if you're trying to work with an artist and get them to collaborate with you, and again, to anyone who's just starting out, I would always recommend that. Don't think that you know better than the artist just because you're a writer. Unless you're illustrating it yourself and you're an experienced illustrator with years and years of experience of doing comics, you probably are not going to be as good as the person who you hire. Remember that and have respect for what they're trying to do and why they're trying to do it. Because if you hired them based on the artwork in their portfolio or the panels they've done or whatever, you like their work. So have respect for that and use that talent. That talent is part of what you have on your team that makes it more than just, oh, I'm imagining this in my head. Because often they will come up with something better than you could possibly have imagined. And you have to be open to that possibility because they're visual. And if you're a writer, you're probably less visual.
Right on. So far during this process, what has been the one panel that you looked at? And every time you think of my next book, you say it has to surpass this.
That's a really good question. I think Violet is genuinely our best comic as a whole, and I would want our next book to surpass that because Penumbra is also a character that's very, very dear to my heart. However, the single best panel I think we've ever done is in Counting Down from One, or rather it's a sequence of panels, but bear with me here. They are in a public canteen, and as I said, they've gone back in time to murder this person. And one of them, they've met a contact since they were there. He calls himself Arthur. You know, he knows all about their mission. He knows their secret code phrase and so on. And he says that he's come from the future to you know, lend a hand. Because they failed last time, so he's come back in time to make sure they succeed this time. And he sits down with them in this canteen and he says, okay, so how exactly are we going to kill this guy? And then, like, the leader of the group goes, hey, you know, hey, like public place, let's not talk about this here. And then this panel that I'm talking about starts. And this guy stands up, right? He's got his arms in the air and he goes, hey, everyone, we're planning a murder. The next panel is exactly the same thing, but someone's just walking. And then the next thing, someone's just walking and sitting down. And then he goes, nobody cares. And I think that you know, I mean that's something that's been quoted at me a few times at like panels at conventions, and I've had people talk about it, you know, to me on Kickstarters and on the Facebook page and so on. So I think people find that to be a very, very memorable moment, because it's at the same time utterly ridiculous and yet exactly what would happen in real life. Right? And it's sort of, I think it's the truth that rings through, pardon me. I think it's the truth that rings through that makes it so memorable. And yeah, I would like to surpass that. We haven't managed to do so as a single page, you know, a single set of panels yet. But, you know, I think it's very definitely doable. It's just, that was the perfect storm of, you know, we had this moment and this chance to do something that's so ridiculous. And when we were writing it, because John was actually in the UK, he's US-based, but he was actually over in the UK for a convention with me. And we sat down and we wrote this comic together. Literally, we just sat down in this room I'm in now, and we literally just like took turns reading comics. You know, I was reading the you know, the DC series where they made all the Batman into Batwoman and the Joker into a woman, and I was reading all of those. Yes. He had them on his iPad. I was just reading those. And we were basically switching backwards and forwards between reading and writing, and we were just doing that every 15, 20 minutes or so. And we just sat here, and he wrote this, and he went, "Ed, I don't think you're going to like this very much." And the way it was, he didn't have the pause so much. He'd like just done it one panel to the next. And when I sat down and I went, "Oh my God, this is amazing, but let's have a few seconds of nothing happening before he says nobody cares." And, you know, together we really came up with this, you know, this concept that it was possible to go, "Hey, you know, this is something that is so ridiculous that you wouldn't believe it. And yet, here's the ring of truth in there."
Gotcha. That's pretty wild. That's actually a pretty good story about how a collaborative process can actually produce a scene that's a little more intense and sometimes a little more flavorful than just one person is going to concoct on their own.
Yeah, I really agree. And that's one of the primary reasons that I like to co-write rather than write on my own. You know, co-writing takes different forms for me. I do it in different ways. Blue Shift, John pretty much wrote the whole thing. And then I went through and I did do a lot of heavy edits, you know, heavy edits, cut panels, add new panels, that kind of thing. But he had the, you know, the full structure there, and then I went through it. Whereas with Violet, or with Lacuna, we actually split pages up and we each wrote half of the pages and then edited the other person's. And then John did an overall edit for Flow. And, you know, either way works really, really well. I think that, you know, the more that you can make sure that both of your sets of ideas come together, the better the overall thing actually is.
Right on. Absolutely cool. So we got 59 hours as of the recording of this show for the Kickstarter to go. Violet Unstoppable. You had a $200 goal. What is that in
pounds? It's about 150. So as I said, John is US based, so he is the head of comics, and I'm sure that if we appear again as a company, John will be around for any future discussions. He literally said to me, "Okay, well, Ed, I only really did sort of a bit of dialogue editing and lettering on this one, so you're good to go. But if you try and do this with anything that I wrote, I'm going to be really, really angry." So
we're looking at a 150-pound goal, and then $200 US. You're far surpass that right now with 65 backers, which is fantastic. But you have a stretch goal where if you reach 1,200, the digital version of this is going to get some extra pages.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, we achieved that, and we also achieved the other stretch goal on Blue Shift. And unfortunately, as with everything, it's a bit of a learning process. It was a bit of a mistake to put it quite so low on Blue Shift because we put it at 1,200, and we did achieve it. And it actually put a lot of strain on the budget, because I had miscalculated. It's entirely my fault. I'd set up the numbers. But live and learn. But we doubled the length of that comic to 22 pages. Violet is going to be 11 pages, or if we meet this, then it's going to be 13, 14. There are always sort of minor breaks in most comics, right? So we're gonna pick a place that works. I think it's going to be page 12 or 13 that feels like the right place to me in this particular comic. And yeah, I mean, we'll happily add those in. We'll happily send out that digital with those extras. Obviously, what we're really aiming for is to double the length. My door's going. I'm sorry. I'll be back in a minute.
Yes, sir.
Hello? I'm really sorry. It's actually a delivery, so I'm going to be 5 minutes or so. He's coming up, but I am really annoyed.
That's okay. Is that
possible?
We could actually. We've almost reached the hour now. We're just a little 10 minutes shy. So, as a closing thought, if you could tell one person out there who's thinking about getting into comics the one lesson that you've really taken away from all this, as like something that really hits home, what would you say to them?
Don't try to do it alone. You do not know better than everybody else you might run into. Get other people to read what you've written. Find someone with experience to comment on it. Find an artist who's going to contribute rather than just parrot.
Excellent.
Don't try and do this all alone, because you won't do very well.
Well, we'll cut that right as the buzzer hits and say happy birthday and thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you very much. And yeah, guys, if you're interested, please check out Violet Unstoppable.
Right on. And look out for the beeping.
Thank you very much.
Hey, have a great day, sir.